Support comes from Catholic Charities. Driven by the message of love your neighbor, Catholic Charities is focused on improving lives in Maryland. Give the gift of love during this holiday season and learn more at cc-md.org/love.
I was going to go ahead and buy a house in the high desert of California on Monday. And he said, Maria, I'm really sorry. I'm not a financial planner, but I would suggest that you not buy the house.
As a young boy, I was flamboyant. I was a sissy. I liked drama. I did theater. I was a weird kid.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast. I'm Jessica Henkin.
And I'm Laura Wexler.
And this week on the podcast, Best in Show, two incredible souls, two great performers, share stories that are an object lesson in how to live. So this first storyteller is
an old friend of Jessica's, and you will hear Jessica name checked multiple times in this story. And basically this guy, Joshua/Peaches, is saying that she was terrifying.
We came up in the 80s and early 90s in a conservative sailing town that was mostly wealthy. We went to a Catholic school and we were decidedly square pegs.
Yeah.
And I think that we spent so much time feeling scared and belittled that when it was our time to rise, we just were like, take no prisoners.
Well, he mentions that you could like cut a popular girl down to size. Do you remember any of the things you would do?
I don't. I've tried to. You know what? I have. I've moved on. And I really feel like it's funny because now I have the exemplars of both of my point of view and what I perceive to be my enemy's point of view in my children.
Yeah.
And so I have a lot of empathy now for the people that I was so mean to. Now,
that's
they
growth.
Were also
You've really grown.
They were mean to me, but like I probably wasn't doing a lot to like make them like me.
Yeah, think.
But I also do remember some of the things I said, and they were not very nice.
Well, you guys had your crew in this story. Everybody take a listen. This is an epic, just wonderful story.
Thank you. I was waiting all night for you to do that. Whoa. And now I'm probably just going to take it out. Hopefully that's okay. I'm much more comfortable holding it like this. Is this all right? So I really just don't even understand why Jessica booked me for a show called The Outsiders. I don't get it. No, I'm just kidding. So I wanted to start my story tonight by revealing something that might be shocking right at the start. I'm not a beautiful woman. What you see before you is an illusion. And I actually am a nerdy guy named Joshua underneath all of this. And like Jessica said, I grew up just outside of Crofton, Maryland, down the road. And as a young boy, I was flamboyant. I was a sissy. I liked drama. I did theater. I did haunted houses. I loved horror movies. I was a weird kid. You know, I was definitely the other. And it was fine. I mean, for the most part, I knew I was other. I probably knew I was queer. But it was okay. I wasn't, shamed by it from my family, which is really great. And I was, allowed to be creative. And then in seventh grade, I transferred to St. Mary's in Annapolis. And so seventh and eighth grade was really the period of my life. If any of you have ever seen the movie Welcome to the Dollhouse, I really relate to Dawn Wiener. You know, I really connect with her because that was where I was told I was a for the first time. And this was the later 80s. I was told I was going to get AIDS. I was also, you know, kind of treated as though I, you know, might have AIDS. And I was very aware of my difference. And I grew up Catholic, so I love Jesus. And, you know, grew up in the Catholic Church. I enjoyed being Catholic. at this time, it wasn't just the kids who were telling me I was different. It was also the nuns teaching me who were telling me I was probably going to go to hell, you know, in the afterlife. So 7th and 8th grade were tough years for me. I sort of caved in on myself. And in high school, I just learned to not be as flamboyant. I learned not to be as big of a sissy. And it was sort of survival of the fittest. And Catholic school kids, you'd think they'd be nicer. They're not. They're meaner. No, I don't know. But I think they are. So stand by that fact. And it was in high school that I sort of found my squad, my tribe. And there were four friends of mine, all girls, who really I bonded with the most. Sarah, who's here tonight, was this smart, creative friend who I co-wrote a play with, and we presented it in front of the school. Jessica was the freak. But in the best possible way, the Firuza Balk from The Craft. She was scary. I mean, if you were popular and you were in her zone of target, you could get a mouthful, you know, and she would reduce popular girls to tears. And I loved it. She was so cool and badass. She wore black eyeliner, even though she wasn't supposed to, and rolled her Catholic schoolgirl skirt up high enough that, you know, she'd sometimes get in trouble. She was, you know, she was a hero. She also introduced me to the gender-bending lead singer Robert Smith of The Cure and Jane's Addiction and other cool music. My friend Holly, who I ended up going to multiple things like homecoming and prom with, was also queer. We never talked about it, but we both knew, you know. And Holly was who I went to see the Rocky Horror Picture Show with for the first time. And Glenn Burney at the Marley Station Mall. And let me tell you, that was a life-changing event for me, you might imagine. You know, I often describe Rocky Horror as my sort of It Gets Better video, because that was where I was like, oh. But it was really Kathleen and her family's obsession, her whole family's obsession with renting the weirdest movies they could at Mom's Video on Kent Island. And I would go over there to see stuff. And that's where I first saw Pink Flamingos, ladies and gentlemen. And seeing Pink Flamingos and watching Divine and Mink Stole vie for the title of Filthiest Person Alive was a spiritual religious experience for me. And once I saw that movie, there was no turning back. You know, I knew that up here in Baltimore, where I had relatives living, and it was just, you know, just a short car ride away, that you know, Divine ate dog shit. You know, dressed in full drag. I also saw multiple maniacs where Mink gave Divine a rosary job in a Catholic church. It was heaven for me. It was sacrilegious. It was punk rock. It was in your face. And it was coming from Maryland. It blew my fucking mind. So this nerdy, geeky, awkward high school kid found a lot of empowerment through movies and friendship and being proud of being the other. So that when one of the sisters asked me to stay after class, it was ma soeur. She was our French teacher. Ma soeur means my sister in French. That's what we had to call her. Ma soeur actually kept me after class and wanted to talk to me. And I knew I was in trouble because I think I'd been talking during class. And what she said was, "You are destined for a life of misery." And I said, "Oh, really?" And she said, "Yeah, you hang out with all these girls, you act like a girl, and if you don't figure out how to be a man, you're going to have a horrible, miserable, lonely life." And she bullied me that way where no one else was around. And I told Jessica about it recently for the first time. I didn't tell any of my friends. But something in me at that time, because I'd been exposed to the movies, I had friends, I knew what she was saying was wrong. You know, I knew she had been hurt at some point in her life. And I knew that she was wrong. And this was the first time where I kind of felt empowered, you know, as a weirdo or a queer. So much so that later that year, when a new kid showed up, he was a jock, he was a popular jock, and in gym class, and get this, I hated gym class. And I know I'm not alone there. If you were an outsider, gym class was, you know, horrible. And I was in gym class, and this jerk pushed me down, like just decided to push me over, and I landed. And he laughed, and the other popular kids didn't laugh. And I looked at my friends, and I remember Vicky standing there, and Vicky looking at me like, you can't let him get away with that. So I picked up a ball and threw it as hard as I could in his face. And it smashed his face, and I got in trouble. And he said to me, we were going to fight after school that day. But he also said, and this is so bizarre, but I knew that he, you know, he tuned into something. He said, I'm going to give you the sex change you always wanted. What? It's like, no matter how weird I am, where is Tommy, what's his name, today? You know, I just kind of want to know, like, what was going on in your mind that's what you told me? So I, needless to say, I was in the parking lot after school. No fight happened. And really, you know, through these friendships and kind of our group was sort of anyone who felt outsider could be friends of ours. You know, we made it and we graduated. And I ended up winning an award at graduation for drama and for writing. And I left St. Mary's and I said to myself, I'm leaving Maryland and I'm getting the hell out and I'm never coming back. And I wanted to go to New York to go to school, and I didn't. I ended up at Penn State, of all places. And I ended up making a movie at Penn State called Jizz Mopper because I studied film. Where I did drag for the first time in the movie. I wanted to appear in the movie. And after making the movie and graduating, I moved to San Francisco and I started a midnight movie event where I would screen all my favorite movies, a la the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And I graduated 25 years ago. And if you had told me then, or even when I moved to San Francisco and was doing drag as a hobby, that someday in the long, long future, you know, you'd be making a living as Peaches Christ. You'd be loving your life, traveling the world, making movies, friends with people who inspired you. Mink is here in the audience tonight. I love you to death, Mink. Thank you for coming out. Being able to... Yes, let's hear for Mink Stoll. If someone had told me that all of these things that were once used to hurt me, you know, Jesus and being gay and being like a girl, would someday bring me tremendous joy and provide a great life for me and my partner, I would have thought you were lying. But now I get emails and Facebook messages from others stuck in places all over the world who I get to kind of encourage and be their, you know, Rocky Horror or Pink Flamingos. And it's a very empowering and wonderful thing. So when Jessica first asked me to come and do this thing, I knew that I should tell my story as Joshua, not as my character. And this is an odd thing for me, to be talking to you about my life while dressed up as my character. But I knew that the story had to end with me saying, I am proud to come from Maryland. And I am here tonight as the culmination of everything I learned here in Maryland. So thank you very much. Mwah. I love you, Jessica.
Oh, thank you, Peaches. Yeah. And Peaches looked fucking gorgeous that night.
Yeah.
Peaches' mom helped. They came to the Senator Theater together and got ready in like the, because there's no green room. It's an old historic movie theater.
Yeah.
Where did they get ready? Anyway, they looked amazing.
Well, and it was interesting that he says that this was the first time that he was in character, but then telling a story as himself.
As himself,
which was, so it made for a really interesting
vulnerability.
Yeah.
And authenticity.
And then, to me, this is an origin story. Like, it's an origin story for Peaches Christ and the story of, like, how a kid named Joshua Grinnell became Peaches Christ, which is to say, became a person who could live the life they wanted to, you know? I loved it so much.
Yeah. And if you want to learn more about the amazing Peaches, they have, I mean, there's just a treasure trove of information at their website. They do the Terror Vault in San Francisco. Look them up. Amazing.
Before we get to our next story, we're going to take a quick break. This final story for today's episode is shared by Maria Falzone, who, as you will quickly hear, is as charismatic and wonderful as Peaches Christ. This is really just such an all-star show. Again, like, these are people who figured out how to live and really, really done their thing. Maria shared this story at a show we did probably 5 years ago. And it's unforgettable, as you'll hear.
Thank you. So my name is Maria Falzone, and my entire life I wanted to be a performer. And both of my parents were from Sicily, and they were distraught that I wanted to be a performer. You know, it was the worst thing that I could have ever chosen to do. And whenever my dad could talk about it, he would say, I have no respect for those actors. They're all drug addicts. They're divorced. And I'm like, Dad, we have drug addicts and divorcees in our family. And he's like, yeah, but look at Robert De Niro and Al Pacino and Talia Shire. And I'm like, what are you going to name? Everybody from The Godfather? There are other actors out there. And he's like, I never wanted you to do that. But I wanted to do that. And I was afraid to go against my family. So in high school, I went to hairdressing school to make my mother happy. And then I went to college. And I mean, I was not doctor material, but I figured like a psychologist or something would make my father happy. And I wasn't happy. And there was just a point where I had to go ahead and come out to my dad and say, I want to be an actress. You know? And he said, I disown you. And I said, well, you know, Dad, I've been thinking a lot about that, and you can disown me, and I'm going to be okay with that. But I will not be okay without ever trying. Because my whole life, what I've said up until now is, oh, my father won't let me. But the truth is, I'm letting you not let me. And I don't want to be on my deathbed and say, I wish I had. And having said that to my dad, it became my mantra through my life. Like, I would sit there and go, on my deathbed, will I regret this? On my deathbed, will I be proud of this? And I tried stand up, and I tried acting, and I didn't like acting because first of all, there's typecasting. So I was never going to get the lead in the Glass Menagerie. I was never going to be Laura in the Glass Menagerie. I was going to have to wait for someone to give me a role. I was going to have to go ahead and audition. And I'm a control freak. And one of my roommates said, why don't you try stand-up comedy? And I fell in love with stand-up comedy because I could write it, I could direct it, I could produce it. If I didn't like a club, I wouldn't go back to that club. And I did my first open mic, and I was hooked. And then I ate mushrooms, and a voice told me to move to San Francisco. And I listened to the voice because it was so like, in all the blah, 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 it was like, go to San Francisco. And I said, okay, I'm going to San Francisco. And I moved to San Francisco because they had this vibrant comedy scene. And I remember going to Comedy Day in the Park. And if you don't know about Comedy Day in the Park, 20,000 people converge in Golden Gate Park on the polo fields, and they watch comedians all day long. They bring, you know, picnic baskets. And I remember watching Robin Williams and Whoopi Goldberg. And I go, someday I'm going to be on that stage. And I was on that stage. And then I decided I was going to go ahead and do the San Francisco International Comedy Competition. And I came in third, just like Ellen DeGeneres did. And then I was the only woman to ever host the San Francisco International Comedy Competition. And when you were a comedian, there was one thing, and that was to have a sitcom. So I got an agent, and I got a manager, and I was in New York, and I was making deals, and I went to L.A., and I met people in show business, and I fucking hated it. because it was the same thing. You had to go ahead. Nobody was authentic. No one was real. It was about what could we do with you, not what I had to say. And in the middle of that, I was invited to do the HBO Aspen Comedy Festival. And I met this woman who said, you'd be great doing what I do. And I go, what do you do? She goes, I talk to young people about safer sex. I'm like, shit, I want to do that. So I thought, oh, I'll do it just to make some money. And I fell in love with it. I found what I wanted to do. I got to walk on stage and talk to young people because I grew up really ashamed of sex. And I got to talk to them and say to them what I wish someone had said to me about sex in a very open, honest way that was funny. And I had a ball doing it. And I thought, I want to have a baby. You know, so I had to get married, obviously. And I did. I got married. And I remember being in England, and I was doing the 20th anniversary of the Comedy Store. And I was hanging out with the comics, and they're like, oh, come and, you know, drink and do blow. Because, you know, that's what, you know, people do. I didn't. I said, I'm going to Italy to get pregnant to have my daughter. And they're like, well, Maria, that's pretty specific. And I go, well, I'm telling you, I'm going to Italy to get pregnant and have my daughter. And I came back from Italy pregnant, and 9 months later, or 10 months later, had my daughter. And I have the most amazing, incredible daughter. I had this vision of a daughter, and I knew how I wanted to parent her. And she's the most amazing, badass, incredible human being. And it's like the proudest accomplishment of my life. And in her senior year, I wasn't feeling well. So I went to the doctors, and I had to advocate for my health. I said, you know what, I just don't feel comfortable, and I had this attack, and every time I press here, it's uncomfortable. And she said, well, and I said, no, you don't understand. There is no well. I'm not leaving until we find out what's wrong. And so she pressed down, and I started to cry. And she goes, oh, I think it's your gallbladder. Let's go get an ultrasound. And I went and had an ultrasound. And from the ultrasound, the radiologist said, you have a couple of spots on your liver. I think you need to go ahead and get an MRI. And then the call came from the doctor that I had most likely had liver cancer, and I had to go see an oncologist. And there's two types of liver cancer. There's outer liver cancer, right? Because I don't remember the name of it. And then there's inner liver cancer, or cancer of the bile duct. And it's a very rare form of cancer. Only 2,000 people are diagnosed every year. And your survival rate is really low. Like your chances, you have a 3% chance of surviving after 5 years. And so I went to see the oncologist. And I have to tell you, there's this life where it's like before cancer, BC, and AC, after cancer. And my whole world was shifted. And I thought, well, I didn't have a choice about cancer, but I have a choice in how I'm going to be with cancer. And if I'm going to be with an oncologist, I want an oncologist that I like, that I feel comfortable with, who has a sense of humor. And I went in to meet this oncologist, and I'm like, okay, so I have liver cancer. Just, like, what are the chances of it being the dick-sucking cancer? And he's like, the dick. I go, well, I don't like to suck dick, and I really think that, you know, I don't want that cancer where you could go ahead and die in 5 years. And he's like, do you mean cholangiocarcinoma? And I said, no, I mean the dick-sucking cancer. I don't know what the hell it's called. I don't want to know what it's called. I just don't want the dick-sucking cancer. And he will not say dick-sucking cancer. And I'm like, there's no fucking way that I can spend the next how many years of my life with this dude who's uptight. So I go and find another oncologist. And I go into his office, and I go, well, you know, and I've had the tumors removed, and I do have cholangiocarcinoma. I go, so tell me, what are we going to do about this cholangiocarcinoma? I go, you don't even want to know what I call it. He goes, no, tell me what you call it. I go, well, I call it the dick-sucking cancer. He goes, well, you know what? Some doctors do refer to it that way. And I went, you are my dude. And he hung with me, and I called him dude, and I went through my 4 months of chemo, and I came out in January, and I had clean scans, and I felt good. And then in July, I wasn't feeling that great, and something said, I think it's back. And while I was going through chemo, I really took stock of my life, and I saw how much I was loved. Like, it was an opportunity to me to go through chemo and be loved. And people flew in from all over the country to take care of me. And I got to live. in a lot of ways my funeral and make peace with death. And I went back in August to have my scans, and he didn't want to talk to me. He had tears in his eyes. He goes, I'm sorry to say that the chemo didn't work and you have 4 tumors in your liver. And I said, well, don't cry. I had an idea that this was going to happen. I'm like, tell me, how long do I have? And he's like, you probably have, like, you know, worst case scenario, 4 to 6 months. And I'm like, dude, are you kidding me? I just inherited all this money. I was going to get my tits done and my veins done. I just put, like, I was going to go ahead and buy a house in the high desert of California on Monday. And he said, Maria, I'm really sorry. I'm not a financial planner, but I would suggest that you not buy the house. And I said, okay. And I went to my home, to my daughter, and we cried. And I thought, well, all right, 4 to 6 months, what am I going to do? How am I going to go ahead and live my life? And so I thought, you know what? I want to be there for my wake. Like, I want to hear what people have to say to me. And a friend of mine said, you should have a wake. And I said, no, I'm going to have a wide awake. And like Polly, like, I visualized myself, and my daughter and I joked about, like, I'd be laying on a table, and people could come up and talk to me, and I could hear. And then I thought, I'm too ADHD, I can't lay on a table. So I would just stand there, and people, like, a reception line, because I didn't have that. And people could come up and tell me how much they loved me, and I could say, I love you. And then I could hear their eulogies and kind of, like, stoop. I could time them if they went too long and ring. But I was going to say, get the fuck off the stage! No, I'm going to be gentle with it. So before, you know, we were talking about that, and then I posted on Facebook to my friends, I want you to, and I, you know, disclosed that I had 4 to 6 months of life and that I loved my life and I wasn't going to do chemo and I had no regrets and that I loved everyone. And then over 600 people responded and they told me how much they loved me and what I meant to them. And I have to tell you, it was overwhelming that I couldn't, like, I could read a couple and then I would cry. And I thought, you know, this idea of a wide awake isn't going to be fun. You know what I mean? Like, it's not going to be fun. Even if I have booze and, you know, disco lights, it's not going to be fun. And so I thought, I've got to get to the business of planning my death. And I met with an attorney and had my will. And I also did my... the thing when you go to the doctor and they, you know, don't resuscitate me, keep me alive long enough. If something happens here, my kid's in California, keep me alive long enough for her to say goodbye. I don't want any water. I don't want any, you know, food. Just give me lots of drugs and keep me comfortable, you know. And I went ahead and did that. And I thought, where do I want to spend the last part of my life? And my oncologist said, you may want to think about California because it's a right to life state. And so I rented a house in California in the high desert because it's the most peaceful place. And I rented a house actually for a week in Virginia, and I called it Beaches and Bitches and had all my friends come and visit me. And I have a death box, and in it I've paid for my burial because I want to be buried with my mother, because we're Italian and you have to see a body, especially if you're Sicilian, because then you don't even believe the person's dead. Show me the frickin' body. So, and I want a place where my family can come visit me and people can come visit me. And, you know, please, you know, I know I'm a safer sex lecturer, but I don't want condoms left on my grave or... people having intercourse on my grave. I mean, I would be cool with that, but my mother would not be. So, you know, just for my mother, don't do that on my grave. And it's interesting when you tell your friends you're going to die, because now everybody wants to be there when I die. And, you can't say no. You can't be there. You know what I mean? It's like planning a wedding. It's like, oh, shit, I got to get a bigger room to die in now, because... And I have to tell you that I'm scared. I'm really scared. And I'm really sad. Because I'm going to make a lot of people sad. They're going to miss me. And I have an 18-year-old daughter. And I'm going to miss her. And she's going to have a fucking hard time. For, you know, I know how I was when I lost my mother. I mourned for 5 years to get my shit together. And she's only 19. And she really hasn't had that long to hate me. You know what I mean? But I know, and I hope that it happens the way that I want, that I go ahead and lay down with all my friends with me, and my daughter gets into bed with me, and I go to sleep with my daughter in my arms. And that's it. That's it. I hope it comes true. So thank you. Thank you for letting me share my story.
And so, you know, not to make this sad, but you said at the intro, like, figure out how to live. And Maria did that until she didn't, since she passed away about 6 months after sharing this story.
Yeah.
On her own terms.
Yeah.
In the desert with her family beside her. And
yeah, it's interesting because she's really guided in the early part of the story before she knows she has a terminal disease of, like, on my deathbed, what am I going to regret? And that guides her, and then she is on her deathbed and she doesn't regret anything. And that's, wow, what a powerful feeling to have at the end of your life.
Yeah. So that's what we all should hope for.
Wow.
You're going to be with me on my deathbed, and you're going to have to tell me that there's nothing to regret. And I will be with you on your deathbed, and I will say, there's nothing to regret. You did a great job living your life.
You look great.
It's the thing. I like to champion my girlfriends.
For sure. Yes, for sure. Thank you all for listening to these stories. We hope you really enjoy them as much as we do. We want to thank Maureen Harvey for producing the podcast, and we will be back soon with more stories from the Stoop.
Support comes from Catholic Charities. Driven by the message of love your neighbor, Catholic Charities is focused on improving lives in Maryland. Give the gift of love during this holiday season and learn more at cc-md.org/love.